Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow, because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face Off is about to begin, yeah. Welcome to Legal Face Off.
We're getting closer and closer to Christmas time here on Legal Face Off, WGN and WGNRadio.com. Rich Lankov and Tina Martini are here. My name is Sam Panionovich, and Craig Collins is across the glass. Plenty of topics per usual. We'll talk about Donald Trump, possible obstruction of justice, Matt Lauer, the candidacy for the Cook County Board President, and of course, at the end of the show, the legal grab bag. But we start on the phone lines and we go out to D.C. We check in with Professor Susan Block, who's at Georgetown Law. She's a constitutional law professor. We welcome you to WGN, Professor.
Hi, nice to be with you.
The president's attorney has said that Trump cannot obstruct justice because he is the chief law enforcement officer under Article 2 of the Constitution and has every right to express his view of any case. That was John Dowd, who's one of his lawyers, last week. Professor, what are your feelings on that statement?
It's wrong. The president is the head of the Justice Department and can control some things, but he also can obstruct justice if he does so with a corrupt intent. So even though he has the power to initiate and conclude investigations, he can't do so if he's trying to protect his son or himself. So he can obstruct justice. The proof of that is that that's what Nixon was almost impeached for.
Professor, what do you think the likelihood is that if there is a finding that he obstructed justice, that he would actually be prosecuted for that?
He would not be prosecuted while he's in office, but he could be impeached for it and removed from office and then prosecuted. So most of us, I mean, whether or not you can prosecute a sitting president is technically an open question, but I think most of us believe that the sitting president cannot be prosecuted while he's in office, but he can be impeached for obstruction of justice. And if he's out of office, then he can definitely be prosecuted and convicted and put in jail.
Professor, a lot of our listeners hear those terms, and I think it's often confusing to the layperson. Could you explain to our listeners the difference between prosecution, impeachment, removal?
Sure. It's a good question. Prosecuting is what the Justice Department does when it brings a charge, a criminal charge. There's a trial. If you're found guilty, you can go to jail. It's the criminal process that we're very familiar with. Impeachment is a political process that applies only to elected officials, and it's a way of removing an official. It can be, I said elected, but it also can be judges. But it's a political process where the House of Representatives starts it. It basically brings impeachment charges. And if a majority of the House vote to impeach, then the process moves to the Senate where there's a trial. But the only thing that the Senate can do is either convict and remove or acquit. So that there's no criminal prosecution, there's no jail. Impeachment is a political remedy to get rid of an officer out of office. That's all. And then the criminal process can take over.
Professor, some have analogized a sitting president to sitting federal judges when analyzing whether or not Trump in this instance should be immune from criminal charges. Do you think that's a proper comparison?
I don't. I think that, well, I shouldn't say it quite that strongly. With judges, because there are many judges, we often do have, not often, fortunately, but we have a situation occasionally where a judge does get criminally prosecuted, tried, and sentenced to jail. And then the House and the Senate vote to impeach and remove him, because it's obviously crazy to have a judge sitting in jail and getting a federal paycheck. But we have a lot of judges, so the fact that one sitting in jail, while unseemly, is not terribly disruptive. The president is different. He's unique. He's the only one. He or she is the only one. And I believe that it's improper to have a criminal prosecution while the president's in office. As I said earlier, it's an open question, but I think the majority view is that the president cannot be criminally tried while he's in office. We've never done it.
Professor, last question for you on this issue. One of the key pieces of evidence that Mueller is looking at to decide whether Trump obstructed justice is his statement that former FBI Director Comey testified to, wherein the president said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go," speaking of the Flynn investigation. That, to me, I'm certainly not a constitutional law expert, but that to me seems like obstruction of justice. On the other hand, you have to look at all this, I think, from a bigger picture and from a political perspective as well. And I think if any other president said that, it would be almost a clear-cut case of obstruction. The issue with Trump, and he will quite, you know, I think proudly say this, is that's the way he speaks, right? He will hide, I think, behind the idea that wasn't intended to be literal, that he's, that's just the way Trump speaks. So it's almost a defense, I think, to an obstruction charge, his manner of speaking and his personality. But well, whether that will meet the legal criteria of an actual defense, it probably wouldn't. But my point is, from the public's perspective, I think it's going to be tough to prove obstruction based on statements like that.
I agree. I agree that he, that's how he'll defend it, and it makes it harder. But, and I think if the only thing that the obstruction of justice charge would rely on would be the firing of Comey, then I think it would be a flimsy charge. But I think if it comes to an obstruction charge, it's going to be based on more than just that one comment or that one action. There'll be probably other pieces of evidence that Mueller will rely on. And, I think there is a reasonable chance that obstruction of justice charges will be brought. As I said, they'll be brought initially as a political matter for an impeachment, and maybe someday as a criminal matter.
That is Susan Block, professor of law at Georgetown Law. Thank you so much for your time here on Legal Faceoff.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Faceoff. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
You can find Legal Faceoff on Facebook. You can also find us on Twitter, and make sure you subscribe on iTunes. You can rate and review, share with a friend as well. We go back to the phones. We go out to Oregon now, and we join Associate Professor Liz Tippett. She's also the Kress Faculty Co-Director at the University of Oregon School of Law, and she made a nice commentary in Fortune on Fortune.com. The title is Why Matt Lauer's Mega Contract Couldn't Save Him. Professor, thanks for joining us here in Chicago.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Professor, over the past several months, we've been hearing on a daily basis about sexual harassment claims involving many different people, including primarily celebrities and politicians. Matt Lauer's termination a couple of weeks ago from NBC seems to have received more attention than most. What do you think we can glean about the state of these claims and the landscape, given how Matt Lauer's story unfolded?
Well, It does reveal that employers are taking a different tack with these situations. They're trying to get out ahead of the story in a way by deciding once they get the results of those investigations what they're going to do. And if they think that a firing is justified, they'll go right ahead and fire them rather than waiting for a public firestorm first before deciding what to do.
And I think to that point, I mean, I think people are just sort of getting their heads around this new world we live in. And certainly from an employment law perspective, it's, you know, it's a little, I think, the dichotomy is, of course, you want to give credit to these women's, you know, stories, and you want to believe them, and you want to, you know, give them the respect they deserve. On the other hand, obviously, you know, people are conflicted by the need to give due process to the accused. I mean, you know, we all believe in due process. And I think what struck many in the Matt Lauer situation was how, as you mentioned, how quickly NBC decided, I think it was a 36-hour investigation. You know, even in what they called a very thorough investigation, I think inherently that's not enough time to really, you know, do your due diligence. So how do you think employers going forward will deal with this dichotomy of these two balancing acts?
Well, I think actually employers are quite good at investigating swiftly and have always been good about investigating swiftly because they view intervening early as important before evidence gets contaminated. So that they've always been good about investigating quickly. So I actually was not surprised that they were able to get an answer after 36 hours. That would be, in my view, consistent with what employers typically do. I think the real change is how they're thinking about what to do with the results of those investigations and having less time than they used to decide what to do.
Do you see any changes happening with respect to the actual employment agreements that celebrities have with their employers? They tend to be pretty tightly constructed belts and suspenders when it comes to these types of issues. But do you, given the landscape as it's been unfolding the past several months, do you see any changes that are likely to happen with respect to these types of agreements?
You have to imagine that for regular executives who aren't celebrities, employers are going back and scrutinizing those cause provisions more carefully. So typically, a high-level executive will be able to be terminated at any time, but they'll get a big severance package unless they're terminated for cause. And sometimes when you're really in love with a new candidate, you define cause really narrowly. And what happens is if something bad happens, employers are stuck paying out a big severance package if it doesn't meet the definition of cause. So you have to imagine employers are going back and deciding if they need to make that definition of cause a little bit broader to include any situation that would embarrass the company.
Let's go to Harvey Weinstein, because his contract made a lot of news when it was revealed that the company had actually put a clause in there that acknowledged sexual harassment. There was language in there that made him pay a penalty, I believe, if there was further settlements for sexual harassment. What are your feelings on that? And also, do you think we'll ever see that kind of language again? Because the problem, obviously, is that you've now created, you know, a great case to not just go after Harvey Weinstein, but to go after the Weinstein company, you know, for willingly employing someone who had a history of sexual harassment.
Yes. So what I understand about that contract was it imposed increasingly large fines for each time he got in trouble with harassment. Now, I've never seen a contract like that in my years of practicing. It's extremely unusual. But I think what the board didn't consider was they're essentially allowing him to continue to harass people as long as he paid the fine. And that's terrible evidence in court.
Yeah. And you know, there is actually an exception to the rule that you can't go after a corporation for these type of allegations if, you know, it was as blatant as it was in this. So I agree with you. It's pretty unusual and pretty dumb.
Really dumb.
Professor, last question before we let you go. Do you think that we have seen the last of contracts like this? Do you think that corporations will be less inclined to attract talent by giving them favorable language like we've seen here? Or do you think, to your point earlier, that if the star is big enough, then they will be able to have a greater say in dictating these terms?
I do think the balance of power has shifted, because previously it was all about attracting and retaining that star candidate. And now companies have got to be thinking, this person, if they behave badly, might contaminate our brand. And that brand is so much more valuable than any one employee. You have to imagine that employers are really going to work hard to protect themselves from a really bad public relations nightmare.
That's Professor Liz Tippett, University of Oregon School of Law. We thank you so much for your time here on WGN.
Thanks so much for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit dlapiper.com.
Legal Face-Off on WGN, WGNRadio.com. We now go back out. We stay local this time. Bob Fioretti, former 2nd Ward Alderman and now a candidate for Cook County Board President. The website, bobforcookcounty.com. Hello, sir. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Bob, what prompted you to run for Cook County Board President?
Well, first of all, a variety of factors, but certain people asked me during the course of the last 6 months to possibly run for this office. There were other candidates who were looking at running. I waited, as you probably know, and the petition drive opened up the day after Labor Day. I waited to about the middle of October, and I decided after some of the other folks had dropped out that it's time to go. Because we have to make a decision here. Cook County people are being taxed out. We don't have a friendly business environment. It is getting harder to make a living here. And all of those, I mean, I'm dedicated and I've dedicated my life to Cook County and the city of Chicago and making it a place to work for everyone. And I just said, this current leadership there is not done. It does not have the same belief. And I said, it's time to run and make a change.
So, Bob, we would love to hear why voters should vote for you and what you hope to do differently, as I'm sure you've heard. And we've all lived through Tony Preckwinkle's years in office, and she claims that she's done a number of things successfully during her tenure, including successfully closing budget deficits of more than $2 billion, cutting wasteful spending, and dramatically reducing the current inmate population, among other things. Obviously, we're all fully aware of the controversial soda tax that she has had to contend with, the backlash on that. What are you hoping to accomplish during your tenure?
Well, first of all, you know, we are a county that is taxing people out instead of inviting them in. She may have said all these so-called items that she has accomplished, but at the same time, her budget's doubled in 8 years. We've learned that, don't forget, when she first ran, she said she was going to repeal the one penny tax that Todd Strojer did, implemented. And she did that for 1 year and re-implemented it. I mean, we're learning that in this county, it's a penny earned is not a penny saved, it's a penny tax. And we're faced with more and more taxes. And we do not have a government that lives within its means. And all we see are rising property taxes, sales tax, a new soda tax that lasted, and it was a disaster, and more taxes on everything from hotels to parking lots and even the game of pool.
Bob, Cook County is the largest county in Illinois. It's the second largest county in the entire country. Obviously very populous, very diverse. You're dealing with some of the richest folks in the country and some of the neighborhoods that are most in need of help. How do you, as Cook County Board President, how would you deal with the different interests that this county involves?
Well, first of all, I think we have to listen to the people of the county instead of dictating to them. I've been through all parts of this county in the last 6 weeks, and I've heard their voices. They do want change, and we submitted change in the form of the number of signatures, 38,405 signatures for a single candidate. It was more than any other candidate for any office throughout the state of Illinois last week. And despite the fact that the vice chairman, Tony Preckwinkle, of the Democratic Party said that they were going to challenge my petitions, they never did. I think people do want change here. And I've been throughout all parts, the underserved areas that need jobs, to, as you just said, the richest areas. And I've been up there and talking to the people, and people are moving out. People are moving out because of one thing, how the tax structure and how it's being affecting everyone.
So how do you think, Bob, we should be addressing the $200 million shortfall that's been reported as a result of the failed tax?
Well, seriously, a $5.6 billion budget, and you can't find ways to cut this? There was the seven-point program that I was advocating, including eliminating all the vacant jobs, putting a freeze. Tim Evans right now is in a court battle with her, the chief judge of the court system, where he's taking 50% of the layoffs. He's going to court to sue on that. And they were trying to implement furlough days with the unions in his area. I mean, there are plenty of ways. If instead of worrying about, let's have a budget today and looking at it through a year-long process, that we could have, and having cooperative discussions instead of shoving taxes down the commissioner's throats and the people's throat, that we would have come up with a better answer and a better solution.
Bob, last question. Rahm is pretty much announced that he's running for a third term. We've got Rauner, we've got Madigan and Stalemate, we've got Tom Dart, a powerful voice here in Cook County. How are you going to deal with all these diverse personalities to make Cook County work for its citizens?
Well, I think we all have to sit down. We have to have regular discussions, not only with the people here in this county, but with the elected politicians. And we have to go to Springfield and make sure our voices are collectively heard in Springfield and in Washington, D.C. And a lot of that has failed under this Cook County administration here.
That's Bob Fioretti. He's running for Cook County Board President. I love the quote, too, on your website. Instead of taxing people out of our county, we must invite people in. It's great stuff. For more information, bobforcookcounty.com. We appreciate your time here. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Our final guest on this week's episode of Legal Face-Off is the Uber critic, Patrick McDonald from HollywoodChicago.com, and he's going to join us to talk about the movie Roman J. Israel, Esquire. Hello, Mr. Uber critic.
How are you guys?
Good. How are you doing?
You know, one of the few things I know about lawyering is some advice a friend of mine gave me is never get in a situation where you're actually in a trial. So I've taken that to heart.
Especially if Rich is your trial lawyer.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah,
why do we have a movie critic, though, on Legal Face-Off? That's unusual, Tina.
Why do we have a movie critic?
We like to cover, even though we cover serious topics a lot, we like to also mix it up. Legal movies and TV shows. We've covered lots of them before, but Tina's going to ask you about the Roman J. Israel Esquire film.
Yes. So this movie came out, originally it was premiered in September at the Toronto International Film Festival, and then it went wide a few weeks ago, and it stars Denzel Washington as Roman J. Israel, who is a lawyer who goes to work for a large law firm after his small firm partner has a heart attack. So Patrick, why don't you tell us what you thought of the movie?
Well, and to amplify that a bit, Roman J. Israel is not a guy who goes and does plea bargains or trials. in this small firm he's in, he's sort of the brains inside of it, the living encyclopedia of knowledge that his partner always went to. And he sort of has an Augsburger-y kind of aspect to him. He's kind of a fish out of water in society. And, you know, just basically the film rose and fell on Denzel's performance, which was magnificent. However, the story itself surrounding him didn't really give as much heft to the aspect of his character as it could have, I think. And again, you know, it was interesting that you said, you know, you often go and delve into television and movie depictions of the law. And, you know, just like any other person, you know, who's lived in any kind of job, you know, it's not the same. You know, they're dramatic. One of the reasons the law is used as a theme so much is because it's so dramatic. But in real life, that drama rarely plays out. So, you know, to find drama in this story, it was basically because of the oddness of Roman J. Israel Esquire. He's very proud of that ESQ at the end of his name and makes sure everybody knows it. So, I mean, essentially, on our five-point system, I would have given this 3 out of 5 just because of the aspect of the story not matching to the character that Denzel created.
The film, as you mentioned, you know, depicts sort of a dramatized version of what lawyers do. You know, sometimes what we do is incredibly boring that wouldn't make for a very good film. But it seems like I really applaud them for trying. I think the last film that is sort of in the same vein was The Lincoln Lawyer, starring Matthew McConaughey a couple of years ago. But I think, like, the era of really amazing courtroom dramas, you know, we haven't seen those in a long time. Like, I'm thinking The Verdict was one of my favorites, starring Paul Newman. I loved Class Action, which is actually a movie set in Chicago. Gene Hackman plays, like, the crusty liberal lawyer against his corporate daughter. They square off in court. I don't think we see as many courtroom dramas as we used to. Why do you think that is?
Well,
is it because maybe we see so much? There's a lot of TV legal dramas. Maybe,
yeah,
you know, maybe they're just, yeah, all the good stories and actors are doing it on TV.
Right. And, you know, they always want to have that centerpiece case to be the, you know, the main motivator of the rest of the story. And I just think that they're not finding that people, you know, let me give you an example of Marshall. You know, they had a centerpiece case in Marshall, and it was trying to show that his early, Thurgood Marshall's early days as a lawyer. And, you know, there wasn't a sense of the compelling nature of that centerpiece case. And I just think that the Hollywood writers are having trouble finding those key kind of trial dramas that can symbolize what we're going through in the human condition. The most fascinating thing about the law is the human condition. And I think to focus more on that and make it compelling has become more difficult in our, let's say, more sophisticated age. I really do believe that most people know that lawyers don't have that high sense of drama, but they kind of go with the flow of it. You know, one of the great films of the early era, there's a couple of them. The 12 Angry Men, of course, that shows the jury part of it. And To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, that kind of show people the, you know, radical conflicts that take place between divided parties or injustice in the case of To Kill a Mockingbird. But I don't know. I think maybe the tastes, as I said, are becoming a little more sophisticated, or there's not enough to show a high drama level in these trials as we've become used to them in kind of general TV or otherwise drama. So,
Patrick, so just let's switch gears for just a quick second. So why don't we just briefly talk about Denzel Washington's performance? How I mean, everything that I've read has seemed to indicate that he was stellar, as he usually is. How do you think he was, and how does it compare to some of his other roles?
Well, that's an interesting question, because Denzel has a sort of a persona that he places in each of his characters that we've seen along the years. And in this one, he's kind of going anti-Denzel. It's not a, you don't see that Denzel Washington persona in it. He's trying to create a new type of character. Now, you know, he grew out his afro a bit more, and Roman J. Israel seems like a relic from almost the 1970s, both in the style and cut of his suits and his look. And it's kind of jarring in the beginning, because you don't know, is it set in the 1970s, and then you realize that it isn't. And he's just somebody who has a respect for the great justices like Thurgood Marshall and otherwise that have come before him that has sought social justice. So he, combined with his sort of Augsburger-y kind of personality, it all, you know, it's all blending together to create a different kind of character. I think he will get some attention in the award season. He's already been nominated for a Golden Globe. It's unfortunate that the story was a little too simple for his complexity, in the sense that there wasn't enough there. Excuse me.
That's Patrick McDonald. You can find his work on Twitter at UberCritic, also HollywoodChicago.com. Yep. And we will make sure to tell Bill and Wendy you said hey.
Last question. Who's winning Best Picture Oscar this year? Or have we yet to see one?
Oh,
we yet to see.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah, give us a quick 60 seconds.
Dance, clown.
I think The Shape of Water has a great shot at it. It has everything that is compelling, again, about a movie itself. It just it works on all the levels it seeks: romance, thrills, historical elements, everything.
How about the Army Hammer movie? That's getting a lot of buzz, right?
Yes. Call Me by My Name. You know, it's a different kind of romance, a summer romance between two gentlemen. An army plays one of the gentlemen as a grad student and kind of seduces his professor's son. I don't know if it's seduction as more of a mutual coming together, but it's beautiful movie about tolerance and the differences and maybe a European attitude toward. You know, gay men and women versus an American attitude.
Thanks, Patrick. Great stuff.
Awesome.
Legal Grab Bag time on Legal Face Off, WGN, WGNRadio.com with Rich, Tina, Sam. Number one out of eight, the CPS chief has resigned.
Yes, where's our breaking news? Even though it's not breaking anymore, it's like 3 days old. But yeah, Forrest Claypool.
We should have Fee already play the piano again.
Yeah, dun, 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 dun. Forrest Claypool joins the list of many CPS CEOs who have resigned last Friday. Now, he did it, by the way, last Friday, like almost at the end of the day. So it didn't really hit the news cycle till Monday. But the inspector general for CPS, Chicago Public Schools, had released a pretty scathing report accusing Claypool of various misdeeds. Basically, he accused him of obstructing an investigation and lying to the inspector general. It was involving a contract, and it's a little obtuse, but basically the accusation was that Claypool shopped around to seven different law firms until he got one to tell him that what he was doing was okay. Not a good look. Not a good look for the head of CPS, especially, you know, in the wake of his predecessor, Barbara Bird Bennett, who is now serving time in jail. So he resigned after this report. It was kind of interesting that his press conference was almost a celebration. Him and the mayor, spinned it as this. Spun it as this was no big deal. He talked about his 30-year career ending with integrity. He said even good men can make stupid mistakes. So the new CEO, Janice Jackson, is a former principal, hopefully she will last a little bit longer and not resign.
We move on to Rod Blagojevich, former Illinois governor, currently locked away in Colorado, maximum security. Current and former lawmakers are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case again. Luis Gutierrez, Bobby Rush, Jan Schakowsky, Danny Davis, Mike Quigley, among others. They want the U.S. Supreme Court to look into Blago.
Can't get away from Blago on our show, right?
Never.
Hang on.
Have we mailed him the hair dye yet? We were going to do that as a publicity stunt. Did we do that yet?
Not on my watch.
Not yet.
you will detach yourself.
This must have been during the Whiteside era.
Yes.
They did not allow it in prison, but hang on.
Are you pulling up sound effects?
Yes, I'm trying to because you...
because you've been delinquent with your sound effects, Sam.
Well, we're in a different studio. Is that a seal?
That's a dolphin.
Oh. Okay. Not sure what that has to do with Rod Blagojevich.
All right, one more. All right, just random sound effects here on WGN. So back to our point, Rod Blagojevich, yes, as you mentioned, there were several lawmakers, including now retiring Congressman Luis Gutierrez, Bobby Rush, Jan Schakowsky, several of whom have now called for the Supreme Court to take up the case of Blagojevich. Basically, they're saying, I think... very well stated, that it's unclear right now what the standard is for elected officials. The Illinois Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers also filed a brief in support of this petition saying that it's impossible to tell right now what behavior is prosecutable or not. As we all know, Blagojevich is serving 14 years for speaking about doing something, never actually took any money. So in the wake of some other Supreme Court cases that we've covered on this show, I think it is hard to know what action by an elected official is legal or not legal. I doubt, unfortunately, I believe, that the Supreme Court will take this case up. But the only last-ditch effort after that is Trump, his former boss on Celebrity Apprentice, if Trump grants a pardon.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's a slippery slope, and I don't think they're going to take it up, but... it would be good if they did.
Our next story, courtesy of the ABA Journal, abajournal.com. This is out of San Francisco. Multiple women have accused Ninth Circuit Judge Alex Kaczynski of sexual misconduct. Will it ever end? They just keep coming.
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit covers California, some other states as well. But these are six former clerks or externs for Judge Kaczynski, who is based in San Francisco. This circuit is very controversial. It's, you know, perceived as very liberal. This judge has been accused, like I said, of by several former employees of asking them on three separate occasions, according to one accuser, asking them to watch pornography on his computer, asked her if he thought that it aroused her or if it was digitally manipulated. There were other reports about suggesting that a female should work out naked. So, of course, none of this is appropriate. And I think in the wake of all of the other allegations of sexual harassment, I think this is an example of women feeling or men feeling comfortable to come forward against their accusers.
On to Making a Murderer. This is Brennan Dassey, a key figure in that Netflix series. A federal appeals court has ruled that the confession given by Dassey should not be thrown out, and that means that his life sentence will remain in effect, correct?
Why am I going all four in a row, by the way? Who decided this order?
Because you played those awful sound effects.
Tina Martino,
yes,
hold on a second.
I didn't decide that order,
hang on,
mister.
See, I bought the cheap version of it.
The rooster?
That's someone waking up Massey in prison. That's the justice train that he'll never see. Anyway, so Brennan Dassey, was one of the stars. Can we call it a star of the documentary, Making a Murderer?
I think so.
He had appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, as you mentioned. The central issue was whether his confession should be thrown out. If you watch the series, as millions and millions did on Netflix a couple years ago.
Did you both watch it?
I actually did not.
I was like, Huck, really?
I'm sure you were. You were hooked enough for both of us.
It was incredible. He gave these confessions, but he was not competent, in my opinion, and in the opinion of at least one of the dissenting judges. There were three dissenters. They said that he was an intellectually impaired juvenile. He was subjected to psychologically coercive techniques. If you watch the documentary, it's clear that that was the case. Now, of course, the prosecutors argue that that was all manipulated, that that was edited, and many people who watched the film said that. The court agreed, and now he's appealing to the Supreme Court.
You have a sound effect for that, too? Or?
I do. Hold on.
See if you can find one for a swan. Oh, wow.
I'm gonna work on the swan.
Because yeah, I was gonna say the next few stories. There are a ton of great sound effects.
I don't exactly know what that is. All right, so Tina will leave this one off. It'll give you enough time to pull up a swan sound effect. Don't know what that was either.
Yeah, I have no idea.
So Anthony Hensley took care of swans for a living. Then one turned on him and actually ended his life. What do we know about this?
Yes. It's a very sad story, actually, and one that befuddles me because I don't understand how we got where we did. But the wife of a man who drowned, Anthony Hensley, during a 2012 swan attack in a retention pond in Des Plaines, is now suing the companies that own and operate the condominium complex where the attack occurred. Apparently, Anthony Hensley worked for a local company named Knox Swan and Dog, which actually rents out swans as a goose control.
By the way, who knew that was a thing?
What?
A swan company.
Goose control?
Yeah, goose control.
Yeah, I didn't know that that's what you did
the
when you want to control geese.
The geese are powerful.
They are powerful, but apparently swans are pretty powerful, too, as this story unfolds. So he was out in his kayak taking care of the birds when a nesting swan, and apparently nesting swans can be very territorial, unfortunately attacked him in the kayak and made him tip out of the kayak. Apparently, he was not able to swim back to shore. The fact that he was wearing heavy boots and clothes hindered his ability to get back to land, and he unfortunately ended up drowning. His death had been ruled accidental. But his wife mentions in her lawsuit against the property management companies and the condo and homeowners associations that they knew or should have known that swans can be very dangerous and territorial and have a high propensity to attack, especially when they're nesting.
But wait, let me jump in. I mean, listen, we don't want to make light of someone who died. That's
but you're
terrible.
About to make light
but
of somebody
light
who
of
died.
But of the lawsuit. The lawsuit is nuts. Like, your words were just that the defendants, the condo association, should have known that the swans were dangerous, right?
Yes.
He worked for a swan company.
I understand. I do not get it. It is crazy.
I mean, this guy was a swan expert. If there's anyone in the world who would know the risk of being in that body of water in a kayak, it would be a guy who's employed by a swan company. So, yeah, I mean, listen. Terrible tragedy. A lot of sympathy to his family, but I don't sympathize to the extent that I would, you know, even entertain this lawsuit. I think it's an easy motion to dismiss.
I mean, my guess is he couldn't swim and that he had no idea how to swim.
Right, and, but whose responsibility is that? Right?
Well, it's not the condo association's responsibility.
Yeah. Probably the wrong career.
Probably not
swim.
A good idea to be in a kayak.
Yeah, probably not.
If I didn't go to law school, I probably wouldn't try and be a lawyer. You know, that would be...
I don't know. Other people have done it.
Didn't stop our former co-host. Hang on. Let me get a rim shot. Hang on. Let me try that again.
All right. I'll move on while the rest of us stay behind.
Yeah, our sound effects will be delayed.
Sleeping jurors have been dismissed in two recent federal trials. Not local, not circuit, federal trials. Two sleeping jurors have been dismissed. And the question the ABA Journal is asking, are attention spans shorter? Clearly, I think they are.
Yes, I think so. So jury consultants recently told the Wall Street Journal that the issue of sleepy jurors may be getting worse in the era of smartphones, which is making people have shorter attention spans.
One of the jurors said he likes to sleep in his spare time, by the way.
Well, yeah, I think we all like to sleep in our
spare
time.
Yeah, they asked him what his hobby was, and he said sleeping. Who would figure that guy would be a candidate for sleeping during trial?
Yes. So he was dismissed from the trial of a Turkish banker who was accused of helping Iran evade U.S. sanctions. I can understand why you don't want someone like that on a jury like that. The second sleepy juror was dismissed from a trial involving three former South American soccer officials who were accused of corruption. So what is a trial lawyer to do to keep the jurors awake? I would love to hear your answer first, Rich. What do you do to keep your jurors awake?
Keep a baby in the courtroom?
That's a kitty. I employ kitties.
Oh, it's a cat. It's hard to tell all these sound effects off your phone.
You got to speak loud, right? I mean, listen, this goes to, we're joking about it, but as someone who's tried many jury trials, the key is communication, right? I mean, the key is making that connection with the jury. It's just like an audience. It's just like a performer making a connection with the audience. And if you're not doing that well, then they're going to fall asleep because it's boring stuff. So it's important to have basic communication skills. Make eye contact. Speak loudly. Speak in a way that is not, you know, have some energy to your voice. All that basic stuff.
Break into song, you know, start singing some Springsteen
songs.
Sound
effects are amazing, too.
Have either of you seen a sleeping juror ever?
Oh, I've seen them.
I've seen them, yeah.
Doze off for sure.
Yes. And also, what do you do, though, when you've got a sleeping judge? Those happen, too.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, then you just...
Then you just cry.
Objection.
You go up and bang the gavel for the judge.
Yes.
Wake up!
Yeah, I mean, there are many judges who doze off. I mean, they're, you know, very frequently they're older men and women. So, yeah, it's, you know, you get lost. Some of these trials get, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks. Very technical, you get lost in that.
From sleeping jurors and judges to beer, why not? Bud Light delivered a cease and desist letter to a Minneapolis-based craft brewer using a man dressed as a town crier who declared in theatrical tones that the phrase "dilly dilly" is the motto of our realm. There's a problem with the dilly dilly beer.
Dude, you like just did the whole story again.
What?
Step on the headline there, Sammy.
There's enough depth there. You're supposed to react.
Just say yes.
Yes. So, yes, agreed. That's absolutely right. So that is a very different tack than we trademark lawyers tend to take when we're trying to get infringing activity to stop. Usually we just send a letter, return receipt requested. Bud Light decided to send an actor dressed as a town crier to deliver the language of the cease and desist. So Modest Brewing Company decided to adopt the phrase dilly dilly as the name of one of its beers. And had found out a few days before they ended up getting the cease and desist via town crier that Bud Light actually uses dilly dilly as a phrase in its advertising. So as part of his soliloquy, the town crier was reading from a parchment scroll, said in part, "Disobedience shall be met with additional scrolls, then a formal warning, and finally a private tour of the pit of misery." So the town crier went on to ask that Modest make this beer a limited run and offered it 2 seats at the Super Bowl with Bud Light executives to watch the festivities and to enjoy a few Bud Lights on us. So I have sent many cease and desist letters in my career, and I have to say that this is probably the most original way I have ever heard somebody sending a cease and desist. I think it's pretty effective not only to get a laugh and get people to stop in a more cordial way, but it's also a great way to prevent PR backlash. And we've all seen a number of cease and desists over the years that have been sent that hit the internet and go viral.
See, I knew you'd recover. I knew you were smart enough, even though I read the headline.
Are you directing that to me or
yes,
to Rich?
Well, you got upset that I read the headline. All right, here we go. Our final topic on the grab bag.
Hang on. Pistorius wants to opine on that. Hang on.
Our final topic, Tina. Steely Dan lawsuit. There you go.
Okay, are you sure you don't want to like go further than that?
That's it. That's it.
So this is making me very sad, as I'm sure Rich is getting ready to pull up some Steely Dan off of Asia. So around Thanksgiving, news broke that Donald Fagen, co-founding member of Steely Dan, was suing the estate of his late bandmate and co-founder Walter Becker to maintain control of Steely Dan, both the band as well as the name. In his lawsuit, Fagen claims that he had received a letter shortly after Becker died from his estate's lawyer saying that the buy-sell agreement that the duo had entered back in 1972 was unenforceable. Under the terms of that agreement, Fagen would be entitled to purchase Becker's 50% interest in the band, making him 100% owner and entitling him to have full control over the band. Becker's estate responded to the lawsuit saying that it is, quote, riddled with half-truths and omissions, including Fagen's contention that Becker's estate had actually started the legal drama. The estate claimed in its response that Fagen actually sent the first demand letter, not the estate, and that the estate had been trying in good faith to settle with Fagen out of court and that Fagen had proved very difficult and had already been through 2 lawyers. So it'll be interesting to see how this one turns out. I hope that they're able to settle it quickly so that the legacy of Steely Dan is not diminished.
I had it ready, too. Same song.
Name that tune.
Reeling in the ears. Oh, you're going to stop it there? of the Cuervo Gold.
Come on, this one.
What's the name of the song? I don't know the name, but this is the Cuervo Gold song.
Yeah. How about this one? That's a jam right here.
Let's do it again.
Yeah. Listen, yeah. This is like a 2-minute opening. Come on, bring on the bass.
We need to take your phone away.
I think, Rich, you need to join Donald Fagen and be the new Steely Dan.
Boom, boom. All right, guys, you want to hear some Steely Dan trivia?
Sure.
It's going to be, Craig is going to have a field day trying to edit the show.
Who is the first artist that they ever wrote a song for?
Mick Jagger.
Woman?
Yes.
Hmm.
Barbara Streisand.
I was going to say Linda Ronstadt.
Yes. What famous comedian attended Bard College with them and played drums in their first band? What famous comedian from the
70s? It's a Saturday Night Live person, isn't it?
By the way, listen to this
intro. Why are you making that face at me?
I think you're cheating. Do you have the answer?
No, I'm not. I'm just trying to remember
who
it was.
You're absolutely correct. Chevy Chase.
Yeah, baby.
Wow.
Play us out.
We're not done yet, though. You can keep it on in the background. Yeah. We have two other things to announce,
right? Oh, right. We do.
Beedee, beedee,
so,
beedee.
Breaking news. Pow, pow, pow. Hang on, let me get my sound effect for breaking news.
Where's Pistorius when you need him?
That phone's about to go out the window. So Tina Martini has been named.
This.
Are you gonna just? You gonna stop? Tina Martini has been named to Crane Chicago Business's inaugural list of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. All right. Oh, that was good.
What is that? mean, is that a crocodile coming after me?
So congrats to Tina Martini.
Thank you.
You can hear her on Legal Face Off every other week. And finally, speaking of car wrecks, the new Bears documentary, 1985, will get a one-night national...
Oh, wait, not just 85.
Well, it says the story on awfulannouncing.com. Yes, the 85 Bears documentary is going to be nationally
released. The only one you need to worry
about. Yes, 85, the greatest team in football history, which was put together by none other than Rich Lankoff and Scott Preston.
Very nice.
National acclaim.
Wow. I want to see you sing the Bears shuffle, Super Bowl shuffle.
I would do that, but as an intellectual property lawyer, you know that that's not a good idea.
We can
saying it on these airwaves is problematic, but go watch it in theaters everywhere. We're at 250. We're on 250 screens. If I could get this microphone, 250 screens across the country. One night only, January 29th, 7:30.
Be there or be square.
Be there, you're all
Sussler
invited.
And I have already bought our tickets.
Absolutely.
So congrats to both of you. By the way, I hear next show is going to be exciting. The last
very.
Show in December. We may we may go out afterwards.
Yes, and Sussler is going to apparently make his presence known among you all who think he's like Santa Claus and doesn't exist.
Yes, he will be there.
Is Sussler ready for credit card roulette at the end of the night?
Yeah.
All right.
There's Sussler right
that's
here.
That's how we roll.
Here's his thoughts on going out next week.
We appreciate you listening, and we apologize for all the sound effects today. We went a little overboard. That's Rich Lankoff and Tina Martini. Congrats to you both. Thank you to Craig Collins. My name is Sam Panionovich. We'll talk to you one more time in December, and then we'll ring in the new year. WGN, it's Legal Face Off.